Hey there. If you like this podcast, you are going to love my new book, Needy, How to Advocate for Your Needs and Reclaim Your Sovereignty. In Needy, I share my unique approach to identifying, honoring, and advocating for the most tender and true parts of yourself that are yearning to be acknowledged. It is an invitation to embody self-acceptance, which leads to meaningful growth in self-responsibility, self-care, self-trust, and self-love. All of the themes that we talk about all of the time on this podcast. Woven with threads of timeless wisdom, honest assessments of our needs, and heartfelt personal stories of transformation from yours truly and others, Needy illustrates a profound vision for what is possible when you listen to the stirrings of your heart and reclaim your undisputed sovereignty in your life. Now, you can get Needy wherever books are sold, but if you are a podcast super fan, you might appreciate the audiobook, which I do narrate, which you can find on Audible. Now, on to today's show. Hey there, it's your host, Mara Glatzel, and you are listening to the Needy Podcast. Here at Needy, we are devoted to sharing frank conversations and true stories about what it means to meet your needs consistently, messily, and sustainably. To get more information about today's episode, please visit theneedypodcast.com. Now, on to today's show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Needy Podcast. I'm your host, Mara Glatzel, and I'm super thrilled to be joined today by Virgie Tovar. She is an author, activist, and one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on fat discrimination and body image. She is the author of You Have the Right to Remain Fat, which comes out today, the day that you are listening to this podcast. And I have been reading her writing online for a long time, so I'm crazy excited for the opportunity to share her work today with all of you. Hey, Virgie, how's it going?
Hi, it's going well.
Awesome. Will you tell us a little bit about your work and specifically why you do the work that you do?
Yes. So I am a 250-pound woman, and I walk through the world like that. I live in San Francisco, California, where being a 250-pound, I'm also a woman of color, right? Like being a 250-pound brown woman is a little bit unusual here. And so I've lived here for about 10 years, and I was, born into a fat family. I was raised a fat kid, and none of that was really a problem until I was introduced to kindergarten. So my introduction to kind of public education, formal education, was also my introduction to fat phobia. And fat phobia is essentially it's an ideology of bigotry that positions fat people as inferior and positions weight gain and higher weights as a sign of immorality, laziness, low discipline, lack of intelligence, etc. That's kind of what it means generally in the United States and the West right now. And so I was introduced to fat phobia at the age of 5, and it kind of took over my life, and it became the totality of who I was. I mean, I learned from my peers and then from mass media and other cultural forces that all that mattered about me was that I was fat and that my life could begin and my life could matter and people would stop being cruel to me if I just lost weight. And it was kind of presented as this really simple, straightforward process. Like all you have to do is eat less and move more. And, and eventually you'll be an average or quote unquote normal sized person. And as with many people who are naturally fat, that just doesn't work. You have to go to extreme measures to lose the amount of weight that one would need to in order to be considered normal. And often those don't even really work. And the other thing about you know, when you're in the process of attempting to control your weight, especially if you're trying to lower your weight, you have to do increasingly more extreme behavior in order to maintain it. So, you know, like the first, let's say, you know, with me, for example, in my experience, right, the first 10 pounds might be really simple because all I have to do is, you know, not eat a certain amount, restrict a lot, exercise a certain number of hours. And those things are difficult, but it was kind of like, okay, this is how I can get quote unquote results. But then the next 10 pounds, a little more difficult, right? Have to be even more extreme, have to be more religious about exercise. And then it kind of keeps going, right? And there's only so much the body can be denied and the body can be pushed before it kind of hits a limit and starts to kind of turn on itself. And so this is the conundrum that many fat people and people who are in the sort of weight loss cycle find themselves in. So I was in this, quite frankly, like self-destructive mode for almost 20 years. And I called it dieting. We're encouraged to call it dieting as a culture, but it really is disordered eating, right? There's not a difference between disordered eating and dieting. And so I, you know, I had a full blown, I sort of was living that lifestyle for a long time. And it was really hard on my spirit and on my body. And I made myself sick a number of times. Like I gave myself scurvy, through not eating enough, and a lot of weird, awful things happened. And then, something kind of miraculous happened where I was introduced to feminism in college. And even though I was still weight restricting and I was still kind of exercising obsessively and restricting what I ate, it kind of was the first break in my understanding of what was possible for my life. And then a few years after that, I met someone and began dating someone who was fat positive. And I'd never met anyone before who identified that way or who acted that way. And it was very healing to be in a relationship with someone who celebrated my body and who really, you know, really helped me recuperate my relationship to food. Like we would be, you know, preparing, because I mean, right, like what diet culture, which I'll talk about later if you want, but like diet culture and dieting really create a reality where people are afraid of food and they're afraid of what food can do to them. And they think the food is bad, essentially. And I was one of those people. And we would be preparing dinner and, you know, he would just gently, lovingly kind of say like, oh, this looks so good. I mean, maybe we could add some cheese. What do you think? Cheese? And I'd be like, I don't know. Cheese is like evil, isn't it? And he'd be like, well, no, cheese isn't evil. Oh, that looks so nice. Okay, we're going to put cheese in it. It's going to be great. And then he'd be like, oh my gosh, that looks so good. Wouldn't it be so nice if maybe there was bacon in it? And I'd be like, oh my God, bacon. Bacon is super evil. Bacon's more evil than cheese. And he'd be like, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's not. Maybe it'd be good. Oh, look, it's in the pan. Right. And it was just kind of like this beautiful, like loving process of him just kind of walking me through, you know, how food wasn't evil, how I deserved to eat things that were delicious. And so sort of it became like food became a source of celebration in this really fun way. And, you know, and then kind of like the final chapter in the story kind of around coming around to being this activist and lecturer person, is I went to grad school and I started doing research on fatness, and I was interviewing, fat women and asking them about their life story and how fatness had affected, you know, how they did, you know, everyday life. And I was especially interested in gender, and I was interested in how being fat had affected their femininity. And it was through this research that I ended up meeting a bunch of other activists, reading a lot of books on the topic. And I kind of got introduced by happenstance to a group of fat activists who became my friends. And the first time I ever met them was in the context of a conference. And, you know, it was like a weekend long thing at a hotel with a pool. And I remember, I always tell the story. I remember, taking the train to the hotel and, you know, and I get to the, the sort of entryway of it, and I can smell chlorine and I can hear laughter. And as I'm walking through the breezeway, I like come upon this tableau of like fat babes wearing amazing swimwear, like really amazing sunglasses, and they're like laughing and talking and like putting sunscreen on each other and floating in the pool. And there's just no, you know, there's no discernible trace of shame in their attitude whatsoever. And it just kind of totally changed my life, right? I'd never seen fat people acting like this. I had just been taught that you couldn't act like this unless you were thin. And it kind of, there was that moment of conversion for me where I realized that like I was going to give my life to this cause, because everybody needed to know that like joy and fun does not have a weight limit to it. So that's kind of like the background story.
Yes. Yes, yes. Joy and fun and self-care too. Because, you know, one of the reasons I so wanted to have you on, Needy, is because, you know, I see you living your life, looking great, being happy, doing all these things, not waiting. And so many of the people who I work with and who are listening to this podcast right now, when it comes to taking care of their bodies, they have that block around, how do I care for something that I don't like, that I hate, that I feel ambivalent about? You know, it doesn't necessarily even have to be bad. It's just that feeling of like, how do I care for something I can't even look at directly? And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that, about, you know, caring for the body that you have right now, the body that that carries you all around the world, and, you know, that that you're in this moment, because I think we don't have enough people talking about that, about like your body's good right now and your body has needs right now, and it's okay to meet those needs and not change a damn thing about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate that our culture teaches us that unless your body looks a certain way, it doesn't deserve care. And you know, that's just, I mean, it's a fallacy, right? And it's also just unconscionable that we're taught that. So I think it's important to, for me, it was the first step for me was to kind of recognize that I had been wronged, that like our culture was wrong. The education I got around my body was not only like factually incorrect, but it was also immoral. It was also morally wrong. And taking the time to kind of like feel the range of emotions when you let that fact kind of settle in. And I mean, to be honest, allowing yourself to feel a range of emotions is part of self-care. It's part of taking care of your needs. I think a lot of times, you know, like one of the things that when I work with people, one of the big mind shifts that I work with them on is, you know, people often think, especially, I mean, around the issue of fatness particularly, they think people hate me because I'm fat. And I encourage them to think, you know, people hate you because they are bigots. And that's like a really small shift, but it's like a very important shift, that to turning blame inward, to turning blame outward to where it belongs, right? To put blame where it really, to put the onus of blame on the people and the systems that are truly to blame. And those people and systems are not you, they're not us, right? We're the victims of these ideologies and people who act out of cruelty. And so, you know, even that, right, like even that refusal to accept blame or the questioning of that blame narrative, is an act of care, you know, and it's possible that if people are really deep in their, self-loathing feelings, that's the only kind of care they're capable of giving themselves right now, because it's kind of like a, you know, it's definitely, like a cumulative process, like self-care builds. Like, I mean, what's so exciting about self-care and also so frustrating is like, you know, all you have to do is put down the one brick and then the other bricks are going to come, but sometimes that takes more time than we want it to. So for me, that was like my pivotal first step. The act of self-care was to question what the culture had taught me and to begin questioning the culture itself. And to question whether or not, my culture that was all around me was actually built to benefit me. And I came to the pretty conclusive answer that the answer is no, right? our culture is not meant to benefit, marginalized individuals. It's not meant to benefit really individuals at all. The culture's purpose is to perpetuate itself at any cost. And individuals might be part of that, but individuals are also collateral damage, right? Like, the loss of joy and embodiment and any number of nice things that humans need and deserve are not of interest to this culture, right? Cultures are entities, they're like institutions. So when we can recognize that, we kind of give ourselves a little bit of that freedom to kind of say, now that I know that, right, now that I know that the purpose of Cosmopolitan magazine, for example, is not to make me feel good about myself, what kind of relationship do I want to have to something that is not invested in me being okay, and in fact, benefit from me not being okay? And I think it's like, for me, it's like following that little trail of breadcrumbs. And so that kind of was the beginning of my process. And then as that began to sort of unfold, I started trying to figure out, okay, well, where can I find the things and the people who do make me feel good, who do see me, who do care if I'm okay? And then that's kind of its own sort of huge process. I don't want to overwhelm people who are like maybe at the very beginning stages of this, but like, so I'm just going to leave it there. I hope that's like a sufficient enough answer.
Absolutely. And, I love how you describe that the act of questioning the culture that is informing your ideas about yourself in and of itself is care. And
yes.
That idea that you can't believe everything that you think, because we're conditioned to think about ourselves a certain way and to see ourselves a certain way and to see, to view what body is a good body in a certain way. And when we start doing this work on ourselves, we think that those voices in our head are absolute truths, but really they're a product of our families of origin or, the culture that we were raised in, the kinds of things that we learned along the way about bodies.
Yes.
So, Virgie, what does taking care of yourself look like for you these days, like on a daily basis?
Yes. Oh my gosh, there's so many things, right? Like the first thing I want to share is it's such a like tool that I just started using that I think is so amazing. So I actually decided at the start of summer that I was going to vision board my summer, and I was going to commit my 3 months to the page, to the written page through a calendar that I made myself. So I literally took 2 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. I thought about the things that I wanted to see in my summer, and I found images. I'm a subscriber to Martha Stewart Living. I love that magazine so much. And so I sourced all of my images from Martha Stewart Living. There's things like sunglasses and like peaches with mint and like a beautiful bouquet of flowers and dresses that are cute and bikinis and stuff like that. And so it was kind of like, this is what I want to manifest. This is what I want to see. This is what I want to make happen in my summer. And then the second 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper was just, I wrote out the 3 months and I kind of put some special dates on it that I was looking forward to, like, oh, I'm going to go to this weird concert at the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk and Berlin is playing and I love the Top Gun soundtrack, so I'm really going to look forward to that. And then, you know, I know that I'm going to be doing these interviews. I know I'm going to be doing a little trip to New York, and I'm really looking forward to that. And so I kind of put these little highlights that I knew were coming up, and I kind of just put it right next to my bedroom door. And so I look at it every single day. And then I started to kind of collect around it all these little pieces of like memorabilia, ephemera, of things that have already happened. So like a little map of like a trail I did, and like a little postcard of an exhibit I saw at the MoMA, and like little kinds of things like that. And for me, it's like that savoring, that intention, that planning, that like claim to manifestation, are all parts of like how I take care of myself and kind of like, yeah, myself and my body. I don't necessarily always separate the two. So like I wanted to share that, and I decided that I'm going to be vision boarding every season moving forward. So there are kind of these, what I've really started to realize now, and I just turned 36. So like, I really started to realize that the body really is like in tune with seasonal changes. Like our body is designed to kind of do different things during different seasons. And our body is like, and I mean, our body, yes, and also our spirit, right? Like essentially, like if you look kind of, I'm somebody who like loves astrology and loves kind of like spirituality and loves like all the woo crystals, all the things, Stevie Nicks, love it. And so, you know, like in that realm, different seasons symbolize different things. So for example, summer is a time when you expand and you take risks and you focus a lot on play, which makes total sense. The sun is out, right? You like are wearing less clothes, and it makes sense that that's like an expansive time. As you come into fall, fall is a time for introspection. It's a time when you kind of take stock of like, you know, your feelings and emotions and whatnot. And then as you kind of come into spring, then you take the information from those seasons and you're like, what works, what doesn't work? And so there's kind of a cleaning, cleansing process that happens then. And so for me, doing this vision boarding and putting all this intention into these different seasons is an extraordinary act of self-care for me. In terms of kind of more mundane things, I get a lot of sleep. like I'm somebody who prioritizes, I'm like an 8 or 9 hour a night kind of a person. I work for myself, so it's kind of my schedule is a little bit more flexible than I think perhaps many people's, but sleep is so integral to my emotional and physical health, and sense of well-being. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I definitely feel like sometimes it's easier for me to prioritize my desires over my needs. Those are different things. But sometimes I need to prioritize my desire over maybe like a physical need because it's fulfilling a spiritual need that I have. So like perfect example, one of the things that comes up a lot in the work around like food and body size and weight is like people are really terrified of the idea of emotional eating. Like a lot of people think they have an emotional eating problem. Like they eat when they're not hungry, and this is like a huge, huge, huge issue for them. And this is the source of like all of the badness in their life. And I'm someone who questions kind of like, that narrative. And so, right, like in my head, I'm like, sometimes I know that, there's something going on emotionally inside that like needs to kind of be reconciled, and I might not be able to prioritize like a physical need. I'm trying to think of like a good example of that. I have a perfect example. So I had for a long time, it's kind of recovered now, but I had kind of a low back hip kind of strain injury that happened several years ago. And I was going to the chiropractor, and you know, like I started with this one chiropractor, and she was really great. I really liked hanging out with her. And she kind of gave me this like laundry list of all of these things that we had to do, that I had to do in order to fix my injury or to help my injury. And it included things like I could not wear any shoe that had a lift on it. So no heels, nothing, no kitten heel, no wedge, nothing. I had to wear dance goes, which I hate. So you can't wear belts. You can't wear jeans that go above this point in your hip. You have to get a new bed. You have to eat salmon. She was like literally redesigning my entire life because of this injury. And I was kind of going along with it because I thought she was sort of an expert in this. And then on total happenstance, total whim, I ended up going to this other chiropractor. I think she was on vacation. And so I went to this other chiropractor and it was wild, right? I show up and it's like in this neighborhood in San Francisco called the Marina. And I was like, oh, and the Marina is kind of like a ritzy part of town. And I was just like rolling my eyes, right? I was just like, oh my God, really? I'm getting adjusted in the Marina right now. And it was like wild because as I go into the waiting room, I see all of these, really beautiful women like wearing really amazing outfits. And I'm like, wow, they really dressed up for their adjustments. Like what's going on? And then the chiropractor opens the door and he's like this total bro. He's like a hot bro. Right. And I'm just like, oh, like I understand these women don't even have injuries. They just want this dude to be touching on them. And I love it. His name is Ryan and he like he's wearing like a polo shirt and his sleeves are kind of pulled up to show off his like buff arms and stuff. Anyway, so I'm immediately like, no, this is not my chiropractor. I do not like this guy. But anyway, I've already paid. So I go in and he's asking me a bunch of questions and then he's like, okay, let's get on the table. And I'm sort of telling him about my chiropractor and all the things that she's telling me that I have to do to make my injury feel okay. And he was like, has it occurred to you that perhaps the joy of wearing high heels is the most important thing that you need for your recovery?
Okay.
Ryan bro chiropractor was like a sneaky Buddhist. And so I think like that's the perfect example, right? I mean, everyone kind of knows that if you have a back injury, high heels are not your best friend. But Ryan was trying to tell me that if we prioritize joy and if we lean into joy, that is actually the number one priority in healing the body. And I think that I always took that lesson with me, right? Like, and I think sometimes our needs and our desires are like aligned, but sometimes one has to take priority and it's okay to lean into that, and kind of trust that everything's going to be okay, because chances are, right, like there's some like hidden thing, enveloped in the desire that we very much actually do need. I don't know if that got too conceptual, but like, I think I'm just going to stop there.
I think that's fantastic. And also, that undercurrent there of when you hear somebody tell you something about your body, it's not necessarily true or right just because they are a doctor or they're a chiropractor or they're an expert or, that, that piece in us that receives advice and says, I'm not sure about that. Like that part of us that's smart. And I think that so often we give that power away to people that we think know better than us about our bodies. And the truth is nobody knows better than you about your body or me about my body. And that there is that additional component to it that, maybe escapes modern science.
I think I kind of want to close the loop on the emotional eating piece in a second, right? Because I have two thoughts, right? Like one, there is no such, like, yes, there are objective scientific realities, right? But when it comes to what's happening in our body, there aren't a lot of like objective, every single human is the same, right? And one of the pieces of evidence that points that is the fact that I learned from talking to For example, Linda Bacon, who is an expert in the field of health at every size and is the author of the book Health at Every Size, one of the things that I learned while talking to them was that people metabolize food differently depending on their mood. So if you're in a good mood, you are likelier to absorb more of the nutritional value in food than if you're in a sad mood or a bad mood. So like this idea that you can kind of lay down a plate of food, the same plate of food in front of 100 people, and it's all the same function, it's just a myth, right? Like, I mean, our mood and our spiritual lives and the spiritual selves are extraordinarily important in all of the things that we do, right? And so when we prioritize joy and intuition and all these kinds of things, right, we're like, we are taking care of our physical bodies in this like sort of mysterious alchemical kind of a way. And I think to sort of close the loop on the emotional eating side, I think that people have, I mean, as I had mentioned earlier, had a lot of anxiety around food. Right. We're taught to be afraid of food. And so a lot of people feel like they eat too much or they eat emotionally and it's a source of extraordinary consternation or whatever. What I'm arguing is like, throw out all of the guilt, throw out all of the guilt, throw out all of the pathology, throw all of it out. Right. Just recognize that like, if you are able to create for yourself a shame-free, uncharged environment in which you can eat however you want, however you need, without judgment, right? I guess what I'm saying is like, there's no need to have this like shame, guilt side of this thing, right? You can just do the thing and have no judgment attached to it. And like, and know that what you're doing around food or whatever, like some part of you really, really needs that, right? And it's probably your body, right? Because a lot of times when we're in that cycle of denying ourselves and restricting and quote unquote dieting, right? Our body is actually really, really hungry. Like we're putting it into a state of extreme need. And often there's an emotional side to it, right? There's a spiritual, like you're denying yourself, you're hating yourself, right? And so there's like this denial that you're having that's extremely, right, jarring to the body. And so like just take all the judgment off the table and say like, I'm going to do what I need to do with this food. I'm going to eat what I want. I'm going to eat when I want. I might eat to the point of discomfort. It's okay. Right. Like I'm not going to die. People do this all the time. It's okay. Right. And so I think like for me, when I work with people, that's a huge way that they kind of push back on like this ideology of just being joyful and guilt free. It's like, they're like, oh, but I have a problem with food. And I'm like, you don't have a problem with food. So I don't know, like I just kind of, that came up for me as I was thinking about, this like desire need, like conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, something that you keep touching on, which I so appreciate and so resonates, is this idea too, that we have these physical needs of our body, but we also have spiritual needs and emotional needs and energetic needs. And a lot of times, if we think about taking care of ourselves, or we think about self-care, or, you know, taking care of our bodies, it's this really very granular conversation about drinking water or getting sleep. And all of those things are totally real and true, and we need them. But we need things that lift us up too. You know, we need to meet those spiritual needs too. And that for me, I always think about it like it's like an extension of the deprivation to say, well, you're only allowed to have this much, when really we have lots of needs and we get to take care of those needs, and nobody's going to know what we need but us. And sometimes we need high heels, and sometimes we need mashed potatoes, and sometimes we need to be left alone. And, you know, that we don't have to feel guilty about any of those things.
Yes, exactly. And I think like what's great about letting go of the practice of guilt is, you know, for me anyway, and I think it's different for different people, but I'm somebody who's very like theoretically driven. Like I'm somebody who really likes to chew on an idea for a long time. And that's the beginning of all change for me. But like when I was getting rid of different kinds of guilt, like sexual guilt, food guilt, body guilt. It was really the practice of sitting down and being like, when the guilty feelings were starting to come up, just sitting down and being like, no, I will not recognize you as valid. And just kind of really talking to the idea itself, and sort of being like this, and I think there's a moment, right, where you have to sit through the wave, right? You have to sit through the wave of whatever feeling, like guilt, for example, is happening, and you just kind of have to like let the physical sensation or whatever of it kind of come through you, and then just be like, no, I just refuse to accept it, the validity of this. I don't know. I just wanted to share that. Like, that was how I, over time, like got rid of these different guilt feelings, was like practicing just saying no when the feeling came up again and again and again and again until it stopped happening.
Thank you. That's so useful, because I think, you know, sometimes the idea is, you know, I'll wait until I have this kind of epiphany and all of a sudden it's easier. All of a sudden I don't feel guilty anymore magically. When the real truth is it is a practice, you know, it's getting comfortable with that and having that conversation over and over again. And that's how we get to the other side, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm curious about what messages you received when you were growing up about your needs or what it meant to get your needs met.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? Like I grew up in a dysfunctional family, and there wasn't a lot of room for there was a lot of room for certain kinds of needs and no room for other kinds of needs. So for example, if I had a need that was in line with what the household needed, then it was fine. So I'm somebody who's naturally very performative. I'm really dramatic. I'm very fashionable, right? Like, and that's, I've kind of always been that way. And because my household was seeking to use me as a source of gaining happiness. And I was kind of like the house clown. I was like the person who made everybody happy, because I grew up in a household where there was intergenerational like trauma and sadness. That was my job, I was kind of like, my mother very clearly states to me that she had me because everybody was sad and she needed someone to make people happy. And so like anything that was in line with that, where like it was a need that was performative and was likely to make people laugh or to brighten their day, that was great. I got so many accolades for that. If I had a need, like for example, I need to feel safe. I need people to stop using me as a source of happiness and like let me take risks that I need to take as a child, so I can become a proper functioning adult. Those needs were completely taboo. Those needs were not allowed. So like, also anything around independence was completely smashed, right? So like, I didn't have a house key until I was 21 and I'd been living outside of my house for 3 years. I was not allowed to walk to the mailbox down the street by myself. So there like any desire for independence or safety were not needs that were fulfilled. And so it's interesting, right? Because like in my adulthood, I see the ripple effects of those things so clearly. So that was kind of in my household, and then in kind of my school environment, which is my other dominant environment, it was similar, right? Like if I had needs around, you know, a desire to, you know, create a certain kind of project, if it was in line with academic goals and my role as like the fat girl in the class, that was all fine and good. But like, I definitely had a need again for like an environment where I could safely operate. And I was denied that consistently because I was, you know, there was a lot of cruelty that I was experiencing at the hands of my peers. And it was met with relative indifference from the adults around us, because I actually just wrote an essay about this called like, you know, 3 reasons I don't use the word bully. I think that in some ways, the indifference of the adults around us was inspired because some part of them thought that it was normal and okay that, like, people were cruel to a fat person and a fat girl in particular, and that there was some kind of social value to the boys in my class being needlessly and endlessly, torturous towards me. So, I mean, that's kind of like, I mean, definitely, you know, I think like a mixed bag around how I was taught to take care of my needs. And overall, right, like, in general, my needs were not a priority unless they were entirely aligned with whatever the agenda of like the older people around me had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking about another recent post that you wrote about boycotting Chill. And yeah. I just want to read a quote from it because it's totally stopped me in my tracks. Just this idea of how we are socialized to be chill and what that the implications of that is on meeting our needs. And you said, being a fat brown girl has created opportunities for me to become intimately acquainted with the social expectation that I be accommodating, patient, long-suffering, unobtrusive, and possessing of no needs. This is like oppression and stigma 101 material. My role, according to culture, is not to make waves and to be a jolly helper who gains personal satisfaction from seeing the lives of others improved at my expense. Can you tell us more about that? I mean, I read it and I read it again and I read it a third time and it just totally stopped me dead in my tracks about how kind of the through line of how we grow up and how we see ourselves, and especially as fat women, how we see ourselves and the needs and like the chill factor, being a person who has zero chill whatsoever. I would love if you would talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, the way that our culture is structured is super. Okay. I mean, it's like, our culture is structured around artificial hierarchies introduced by a minority of people in power in order to maintain that power. It's important to recognize like the fact that like there's a lot of unfairness, there's a lot of hierarchy, there's a very small number of people who are ultimately benefited at the cost of everyone else. Like these are artificial like modes of existence. Modes of existence that were introduced in a very particular time in history, in a particularly violent time in history, right? Like when, you know, people from like Europe, for example, were colonizing people and enslaving them all over the world. And so like, it's important to recognize the culture as we know it comes from that period, comes from that era. And it's, you know, in that structure that we're currently sort of forced to live under, it is designed that like most of the people will act as supporters to a tiny minority of people. Right. And like, and there's different kind of, there's different kinds of like levels to that. Right. And the way this plays out socially is, that there is a tiny minority of people. I keep thinking about my childhood. So I'm just going to use the classroom as an example, like childhood, you're a kid. Right. And for me, it was like, we're in a classroom, right? Let's say 30 kids, right? And there's like a few kids, there's like maybe three or four kids who are at the top of the hierarchy. And they're people who are protected from aggression, from like cruelty, from teasing and quote unquote bullying. And then there's like everyone else, right? Like, so the 26 rest of us are on some level of the receiving end of that. And oftentimes the four people at the top are like either the people who are meeting out the cruelty, or like are people who are benefiting from the cruelty being meted out. So it's like, great. And so if you think about that, that's kind of on a small scale, the kind of proportional like numbers, relatively speaking, to like who gets to be protected, who gets to thrive, and at the expense of everyone else, right? So it's like there's 26 of the rest of us who are serving some kind of social role in bolstering these four people up. And there's different levels, right? So for example, like maybe there's someone who is, there's a group of people who are just outside that those four people. And maybe there's something a little bit weird or strange about them. But they're close enough to those people that like, maybe they're getting some cruelty and mean stuff happening to them, but like, it's not as bad. And there's a ring outside of that. And those people are a little bit weirder, a little bit more marginalized, a little bit less successful at like being quote unquote normal. And they're getting a little worse. Then there's kind of like the level below that, right? And they're like getting it the hardest. And these are the people who are the most marginalized, the people who are the least likely to kind of ever be absorbed into the idea of what is normal and acceptable in our culture. And that's kind of how hierarchy works on small scales and on large scales, right? But it's important to recognize always in that is like the ultimate social function is that the people who are through effort or through happenstance, the best at fulfilling the culture's expectation of normal, those people are always going to get the most because they symbolize success. They're the carrot, right? And then the cruelty that everyone else is getting, that serves a social role of acting as the stick. So everyone is kind of playing their role, you know? And so it's important to recognize that like if your role in society is that you're like a fat woman, you've been assigned the task of like holding up fat phobia, right? Like, because essentially without fat people, fat phobia, like, I mean, it wouldn't exist. It can't exist, right? Because like, people have to see that someone is getting punished, right? And like fat people serve as like this public display of social punishment. Because we see through media and through interactive experiences out in the world, that fat people, fat women in particular, get treated very poorly. And this keeps other people in line. It keeps more submissive. So people are likelier to sort of continue to weight restrict or to have an eating disorder or any number of things because they don't want to be treated that way. And so, I think it's just important to recognize that, like, you know, cruelty, bigotry, all these different things, they serve social purposes. They're not like odd individual behaviors that emerge because of weird individual pathologies. They serve a social function. And I kind of want to bring in that, like the bullies article I was mentioning earlier, right? It's not a mistake that bullies go after the very people who are marginalized by our society. Like, bullies are not going after straight people. They're not going after, athletic people. They're not going after wealthy people. They're not going after able-bodied people. They're going after fat people, after gay people, after, you know, disabled people, right? It's not a coincidence. These are the very individuals who are being attacked constantly by subtle and sometimes overt methods in our own culture. I think I'm going to leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. And it, you know, it brings us back to the beginning where you were talking about how sometimes the first piece of care is the unlearning of all of those things that you've been told and you've been taught, and the way that you've learned to see yourself or see your body through those experiences as like that in and of itself is such essential self-care.
Yes.
Yeah. Virgie, thank you so much. I am curious for people who are kind of new to this conversation, new to even trying to see themselves as worthy of their own attention and their own care. Do you have a starting off point? What do you do with people who come to you and say, I don't know where to begin?
Yes, I do have a starting off point, actually. The truth is, even for the person who feels like, I have no idea what my needs are, you know, like, I mean, and I think a lot of us have been there or are there. That's really normal, again, in our cultural context, very common. So I want to just sort of normalize your experience if you're someone who's like, I don't know what I need. Very, very normal. The truth is, right, you do know what you need. There's just a lot of barriers. Like there are a lot of barriers that you've been taught that are kind of living inside of you. And they're artificial and they're socially constructed, but they're very real because they're like living inside of your brain and your body and your spirit and all these things, right? So I just want to normalize that and say, like, you're not alone. You're not a weirdo. And there's a social explanation to why you feel this way. What I will say is, you know, you do have expressions of needs. You have at least, I would say half a dozen, if not more, a day. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, I know for sure every single human who's listening to this podcast has one need a day they can actually access, right? And it might take a little bit of effort to figure out what that might be. And it might be something, and it likely is something extremely mundane. Like, for example, oh, I really don't want to wear those shoes today. I'm going to have to sit at my desk all day if I wear those shoes because I can only walk 5 steps in them. That is an example of a need. That is, I mean, right? Like, it's so tiny, it's so small, and we don't even think of it as a need, but it is, right? So what I want you to do is find that one thing. If it's like, oh, I'm at the drive-in, I really want the cherry cola instead of the vanilla one, right? That's a need. It counts, right? Like, find one need today, right? And like, I want you to sit there for a second once you realize it's happening, once you realize that, and I want you to kind of sit there and be like, oh my God, I just had a need. I just expressed a desire. Wow. Look at me being awesome and in touch with like what I need. Okay. So like, take a moment to like recognize that you had the need. Take a moment to celebrate that moment and just really take a moment to like silently sit with the fact that you're like, awesome. This is the start of like me finding the roadmap to my biggest needs. This like cherry cola moment is like auguring a huge other moment down the road. And so what I want you to do today, do that. And then I want you to do it tomorrow. And I want you to do the next day. And then like at some point, maybe day 5, 7, 14, whatever it might be for you, I want you to then figure out 2 needs you have per day. And again, it could be similarly mundane, and then keep going for like a week. And then I want you to find 3 needs. I want you to find 4 needs, right? And then you kind of keep going. And it's like, there's something about that excavation and exploration of these tiny, tiny, tiny things that like lead us into these bigger moments, right? Because even these small, small, small needs, when we take time to recognize what they are and the value they have in our lives, it's almost like they just create, they're like road openers, right? When we take the time to realize it, we're like, okay, what is this need? This tiny need that I have right now, what does this tell me about me? What does this tell me about what else I want? What does this tell me about like other connected needs? So like, let's say, I mean, I don't mean to keep harping on the cherry cola, but like, I'm like, okay, what is the fact that I like cherry cola rather than vanilla cola? Like, what does that say about me? Like, oh, it turns out that I also prefer cherry pie over this thing. And like, how neat. Oh my God, where can I get some cherry pie? Or like, oh, I like this lip gloss over this lip gloss. That's interesting. Blah, blah, blah. Right. So it kind of treat yourself as like this anthropological project where it's like, oh my God, you're getting to know this human who is you and who culturally you've been taught to like not get to know, and kind of like treat yourself as like, I don't know, like someone you're dating, like a new human, or it's like, wow, you know what, like, and go out of your way. And it might feel kind of fake, right? Go out of your way to kind of be like, who is this person? Right. And get excited about it. So that's my piece of advice.
God, it's perfect. It's perfect. Yes, yes, what she said. Thank you so much. Virgie, tell us about your book. It comes out today for everybody who's listening.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So I have a new book. It's called You Have the Right to Remain Fat. It is, I think, pretty good. It's smart. it's an exploration of fat phobia and diet culture for sure. But I also make connections between, dieting and rape culture, dieting and sexism. I go into pretty, pretty good depth around the history of, the connections between food and morality, in the West and in the United States in particular. It's just kind of a, it's like, in a lot of ways, it's like a deep dive into the ideas that have created our cultural attitudes around food and body size and weight today. And there's also memoir in it. So there's kind of some fun stories, interesting stories that kind of dovetail nicely into the more theoretical themes. It's out from the Feminist Press. And I think you'll really like it.
Awesome. And where else can we find you online?
Yes, you can go to my website. It's virgietovar.com, VirgieTovar.com. And then I'm also on Instagram at virgietovar. I have a weekly column that comes out every Thursday called Take the Cake on ravishly.com, RAVISHLY.
Awesome. And I will be linking to all of those things in the show notes. Thank you so much, Virgie. It has been such a delight to talk to you. I just love your work. I can't wait to read your book. And thank you so much for being here with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Needy Podcast with Mara Glatzel. If you want to know more about Needy or want to tend to your needs with a free Needy toolkit, dance on over to theneedypodcast.com. If you love today's show, pretty please leave us a review on iTunes and join us next week. And as always, permission loves company. So if there's a human in your life that you think can benefit from this conversation, I would be so grateful if you shared it with them. Thank you. See you next week.